Accession number 8760, reel number 1.
General Gordon, reel 1. When were you born, General Gordon?
I was born, which was a village at the time called Hetch End in Middlesex.
Which year was that?
That was Christmas Day of 1911.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a stockbroker. He hadn't got, of course, very far before he was... he joined up in Kitchener's army for the First War. And he was actually killed in action on the Somme in 1917.
Which unit was he in?
He was with a London battalion of the Rifle Brigade.
Where were you educated?
I was educated at Haileybury.
And how old were you when you left?
When I left
Haileybury?
18.
To go where?
And then I went straight to the Royal Military College, as it was called in those days, at Sandhurst.
Why did you decide to go in for a military career?
I think very largely because I'd been brought up in a military environment. Although I was very young when World War I took place, I can remember vividly my father going to war. I can remember the air raids, etc., around London. And then my mother married again, after the war, another soldier who had been commanding a battalion of the Argyll Southern Highlanders. And we were based at Aldershot. And, of course, there again, I was very much in a military environment.
Why did you choose to join the Green Howards?
I've been asked that question many times, and I find it difficult to answer in a way because I live in the south of England. The answer briefly is that there was a close friend of my family in the Green Howards, who I saw quite a lot of, and curiously enough, I went to an OTC camp as a schoolboy at Strensall, which was run by the Green Howards. I was very keen on horses. They had a lot of horses there, which impressed me. They had their band and drums performing for us, and as an impressionable schoolboy, that again left me with a sort of picture of a regiment that... I thought I would enjoy serving in.
Can we go on to the outbreak of the Second World War, and can you tell me what your reaction and those round about you was to the declaration that we were at war with Germany in September 1939?
Yes, it was as a professional soldier, I suppose one could say that one was expecting it, so that it didn't come as a surprise. I was adjutant of my regimental headquarters in Yorkshire at the time, and we'd been preparing for some weeks for the for mobilisation, which we saw as inevitable. And so we were not surprised when the announcement came.
Were people pleased or sorry or what?
I think there was very, very mixed reactions all round. I think some people, there was relief that the tension had been broken and a decision had been taken. That would apply more to the us younger generation. The older generation were undoubtedly very worried and very disturbed because they could remember more vividly what had happened in the past.
Do you remember any positive enthusiasm for the war?
No. I couldn't honestly say that at any time.
Did you come across anybody who was against the declaration of war?
No, but then I wouldn't. I don't think in a military environment, I think it would be very unusual to have come across anybody who was against it. But I can't say that anybody was particularly enthusiastic.
What did people think about Britain's chances against Germany?
I think that the professional soldier was worried because although we'd endeavoured to catch up a little bit on our lack of armament, we knew, those of us who were studying our profession at all, that Germany was a highly professional, the German army was highly professional, and it was extremely well equipped, whereas we were lacking a great deal, particularly in equipment.
Did the long period of relative military inaction at the end of 39 and the beginning of 1940 take you by surprise or not?
Yes. I think undoubtedly it took most of us by surprise. And it caused amongst the younger element a certain amount of bewilderment and uncertainty of really what this so-called phony war, where it was going to lead.
Did people seem eager to get to grips with the Germans or not?
Once one had moved to France, yes. I think one was anxious, really, to get it over. There was the usual cry that went around about, you know, we would like to get this over by Christmas. And so there was a certain amount of impatience with this situation which arose, where neither side really came into contact except through betrayals.
Did you yourself think it could be got over by Christmas?
I didn't, personally, no. I couldn't see how that could happen.
Whereabouts were you stationed in France?
I was stationed with the battalion at Arras, but I wasn't there, I should hasten to add, very long, because I was moved back to Richmond in Yorkshire, because I had done all the mobilisation plans before the war, and they wanted me back there. So I was moved back, leaving the battalion with the 5th Division in France.
You mean you'd prepared mobilisation plans?
Yes.
Did you ever envisage that we might be fighting in Norway before it actually happened?
No, and I think that is one of the basic troubles of this ill-fated campaign. I don't believe anybody had envisaged it, and this is really where our troubles start.
When did you actually get involved with the move to Norway?
All very suddenly and quickly. As I said, I'd gone back to Richmond to deal with the mobilisation situation. I'd also incidentally just got married. And a telegram arrived one night, which as adjutant I opened, saying that the battalion was assembling in Scotland, being withdrawn from France. And a number of additional officers were required to be posted to the battalion in Scotland. It enumerated the ranks required. One was a captain, two were subalterns. Well, I was the only captain available, so I posted myself.
Had you been following the developing crisis around Norway?
Not very much. You must remember I just got married. My mind wasn't engaged all that much on the war, which at that moment seemed very remote and far away from Richmond, Yorkshire. So I hadn't really followed it very seriously.
So what did you make of the news that you were to move to Scotland? Did you connect it with Norway?
Oh, yes. I connected it with Norway. Yes, certainly.
What preparations did the unit have to make to move?
To Norway?
To Scotland?
Well, this was a question from France of upsticking and getting in a train and literally training from their wherever they were, and I can't recall where they were at that time in France, through England non-stop to Scotland. But I should emphasize this was where the troubles began, because moving in that hurried way, all, and I repeat, all the transport of the battalion was left behind. And whether there was ever any plan that it should join us at any time, I don't know, but of course it never did.
It was left behind in France?
Mm.
What did the transport consist of?
Well, I can't recall in detail, but in general terms it consisted of about 12 three-ton trucks, which would have carried the sort of main stores, and then each company would have had about three or four trucks to carry their own company stores and personnel. Quite a considerable amount of... nothing like, of course, what ultimately one acquired in transport as the war developed, but it was quite a considerable amount.
What did you think the purpose of the campaign was?
Well, we were all terribly confused when we assembled in Dunfermline in Scotland of what the purpose was. Rumours abounded. We were told at one stage which we were going to carry out a beach assault to capture Trondheim, for which I may say we were completely and totally unprepared in any way. Then we were told that that wouldn't take place, that we would just have a unopposed landing to occupy that part of Norway around Trondheim and hold it until further further forces were sent to join us. Well, of course, none of those things happened, as you appreciate. But in their hurry to get something into that part of Norway, the powers that be dispatched ahead of this regular brigade, the 15th Brigade, they dispatched this second-line territorial brigade, which had had no training at all beyond elementary training. They were virtually untrained, and they were sent ahead of us because they were more readily available. Again, merely to represent to the Norwegian government that we were endeavouring to assist them. And that brigade got dragged further and further south into the operational area at the request of the Norwegian army. They got sucked into the battle, I suppose you might say, roughly in the area of Lillehammer. And they came up against this highly equipped German force, which included armour, and they had nothing beyond their rifles and machine guns to resist them.
Did you know about this at the time, or did you just find out this afterwards?
We only discovered that when we ourselves arrived at Andalsnes. When we got to Andalsnes, we put in a train, we rounded up some local lorries, and a combination of the train and the lorries, we were moved to a focal centre called Donbass. Donbass in those days was a small village, but an important road and rail junction with a big tunnel, railway tunnel, which subsequently was to prove a tremendous help in our evacuation. And we got to Donbass, and I think it's worth my recalling there the incredible sight. We arrived at this station. It was just a small, you might say, wayside railway station. And we got out of the train onto the platform, and the platform and the railway line was littered with equipment. And I'm sorry to say, British equipment. And this was what we were seeing, the remnants of this territorial brigade. I think the total number of survivors was no more than 300 or 400. And this was the equipment of those that had been captured or killed, I suppose. There were no bodies around. It was just equipment. But we got out of that train at Donbas, and there was complete silence. I think we were all overawed by this sight of a wrecked railway station, smashed windows, smashed woodwork around the reception room and so on, and all this litter of equipment. And it was an uncanny silence until the first German reconnaissance plane came over and spotted us when we were ordered to take cover in the woods.
How had the railway station been smashed?
Very difficult to say. One must assume that there'd been a certain amount of fighting around there. It could have been with some of the Norwegians, because there were Norwegian army elements around, as well as this territorial force, who had withdrawn from the Lillehammer area.
So it hadn't been smashed by air raids?
No.
What was the nature of the damage?
Oh, it was what we call vandalized damage. Now, it wasn't... anything of a serious nature. It merely looked at smashed windows, say a door hanging on its hinges and that sort of thing.
Do you think there was any excuse for the abandonment of this equipment?
I really couldn't comment. We all felt so desperately sorry for the survivors, for what they'd had to endure, when they were so totally unprepared for what they had to face.
Did you see any survivors?
Yes, we saw some. They were used by the force commander purely for guard duties to try and look after the various dumps of food and ammunition as they came up in trucks.
Could we go back in the narrative to the crossing of the North Sea? How did you cross?
We crossed in a fleet of Royal Naval ships. The battalion, in fact, had to reorganize, and this, again, incidentally, proved beneficial. We were on the Birmingham, which I went on, which was a cruiser, and I think it was three destroyers. And the destroyers could only take 60 men, and our companies, our rifle companies, were, roughly speaking, 100 men strong. So in order to satisfy the naval authorities regarding the accommodation, we had to form an extra company, which was, in fact, to prove a godsend. Admittedly, it was they were all small companies, but it did mean that we had the commanding officer had an extra company up his sleeve in order to disperse the troops in the way the Navy wanted on the cruiser Birmingham, which took the bulk of the battalion, and the three destroyers.
What actually was the name of your battalion?
1st Battalion of the Green Hearts. And we sailed from Rosyth, that naval force. We were bombed just before we entered the fjord. We didn't know much about that. We were ordered down below when action stations sounded, and all we heard was the noise of the anti-aircraft guns going off and the ship shuddering every time a bomb fell nearby. And I can assure you it was not a pleasant feeling being stuck down below when you heard all this going on above you.
Did there seem to be any RAF about?
No. This was, of course, one of the tragedies of that campaign. We knew afterwards, we heard afterwards, about this very gallant performance by the Gladiator squadron, but as far as we were concerned, we never saw an RAF aircraft.
What was the attitude of the crew towards you?
Oh, it couldn't have been more helpful and more considerate.
When you first saw the Norwegian coast, what was the sight that greeted you?
Well, of course, it was a fascinating sight to all of us who had never been to Norway before, finding ourselves in these fjords surrounded by steep cliffs with snow on the majority of them. And after the initial air raid, all was peaceful and quiet until we actually got to Åndalsnes. But by that time, of course, it was dark. We only saw the coastline and the beginning of the fjords before darkness, and of course that was the best time we could have possibly have chosen to be landed under cover of darkness.
So you saw no Norwegian civilians?
Not until the following morning. Of course, you see, at that time we were quite oblivious of the command of the air that the Germans had, and we were extremely lucky. We got ashore at this tiny little stone jetty at Åndalsnes. A train was assembled. This is all in daylight. Trucks were commandeered because we had no transport. And everything was peace and quiet. There was no sign of any action, enemy action, air or otherwise. And we got in our train, most of us, I think, fell asleep, until we got to Donbass. It was then, as I was saying earlier, that we got out of the train, and then this first German reconnaissance aircraft came over, and then we were to learn much more about what German air superiority was going to mean to us.
What happened next, in fact?
Well, as I said, we took cover in the woods round near the railway station, and there trucks eventually came up by road and dumped large quantities of boxes of rations and ammunition and so on, and that in fact became the battalion base, and we remained there under air attack for the greater part of that day. And about sometime in the afternoon, the battalion, less one company, was ordered to move further south to the area of Otter. And they moved off, some again by train, and some by truck. It seems an extraordinary way of going to war, but in fact, if we hadn't had the use of the trains, I don't know how we'd have been able to move at all. When we got to the area of Otter, we were deployed astride the river. The river is the River Otter, flowing through the little village of Otter. The village now being considerably bigger than it was in those days. And I remember the first sign of something going wrong was a rumour started coming through the battalion that the carrier platoon had been written off. The carrier platoon, of course, being without their carriers, they would have been a foot patrol. And one hoped that this was just a rumour, but in fact it was absolutely correct. And this was our first encounter, and the first disaster that was to occur. The whole of the carrier platoon, less one corporal who escaped, were met by German armoured cars on the road, and they couldn't get off the road because of the snow, and were literally written off.
Did you see the corporal who got back?
I didn't personally, no. I don't know. I don't think he was actually... He was evacuated, because I think he was in a state of shock and so on, and I don't think anybody saw him at that time.
Do you remember how the news got to you?
The way those sort of things do get to you. Have you heard, it's passed from hand to mouth, that someone gets hold of the story and, like the Bush Telegraph, it gets right through the battalion in no time. But this was our first realization of what we were up against.
You personally were at the base near Donbass at this time, were you?
Yes.
And what were your duties there?
Well, our duties were to cover the road communications. As I say, it was an important road communication centre. And there was this threat from, not only from the south, which the battalion were trying to encounter at Otter, but there was also a threat from Trondheim, which was then, of course, occupied by the Germans. And so this was the firm base for the battalion at Donbass.
What were your personal duties there?
Well, my duties were really... I was initially second in command of the company, and my duties were, to ensure that the platoons were digging in, were under... The most important thing, of course, was to get undercover from this continual air attack that we were subjected to. And, of course, one made full use of all the pine trees there. We used to cut down the branches and build what in one's childhood days were described as wigwams, to conceal ourselves from the air.
Did they work?
Yes, they did, on the whole. We used to be subject to random incendiary bomb attacks. The idea, of course, of the Germans being to set the woods alight. But, of course, there was still snow on the ground. The way it thawed during the day, froze at night, but the ground was damp, and they didn't have much success. But it was quite an unpleasant feeling, this whistling in the air of hundreds of incendiary bombs coming down in a great shower, which we would then rush to and stamp out with whatever we had available.
Were you dive bombed at all?
Not at that juncture. Later on, yes.
Could you tell what kind of planes were dropping these incendiary bombs?
No. I personally had no idea what the aircraft were. We weren't interested in recognizing. We knew they were German aircraft. That's all we were concerned with.
What kind of numbers would come over?
Oh, in small numbers. But, I mean, they were flying at rooftop height. Treetop height, I should say, treetop height, almost continuously throughout the hours of daylight. But the Germans, of course, has always been a person of habit, and they very seldom appeared before about 8 o'clock in the morning. Well, now it's daylight in Norway at that time of year, at half past 3 or 4. But they didn't appear before. They obviously had breakfast first before they decided to embark on their missions. And from then on, until about an hour before dusk, and that meant dusk being midnight, I suppose, one was under continual air observation or air attack. But not in large numbers. I mean, ones and two aircraft at a time.